सोच विचार के साथ मेरा नाम नदीम उल हक है
और मेरा नाम अंजुम अल्ताफ है।
वेलकम टू सोच विचार। टुडे आई हैव द ऑनर ऑफ इंट्रोड्यूसिंग टू यू अ वेरी वेल नोन पाकिस्तानी स्कॉलर / पॉलिसी मेकर मिस्टर शाहिद जावेद बरकी is a well-known figure. In fact, I don't even think I need to introduce him. Almost everybody in Pakistan knows him, has read him, has heard him speak. But nevertheless, I'm compelled to do so. Mr. Shahid Javed Barkhi is a well-known Pakistani economist. He began his life as a Rhodes Scholar in Oxford and then went to Harvard as a Mason Fellow. In between, he became a civil servant, passed the civil service exam in the grand old days and became a senior civil servant. But then he left the civil service of Pakistan, much to our regret, and went to the World Bank and rose up to become the vice president for Latin America, and has been very influential in China as well, well known in China. And he has, in between his World Bank job, he took off some time and came back with Muin Qureshi to become the interim finance minister of Pakistan. He has always been associated with Pakistan, written a lot on Pakistan, books, papers, newspaper articles. He has advised many countries, but I must say his heart remains in Pakistan and he writes extensively about Pakistan and talks about Pakistan all the time. So it is important to have him on this, on Soch Bichar, and I'm very pleased that Mr. Barkhi has accepted our invitation to join us. So welcome, Mr. Barkhi.
Well, glad to be with you.
Barkhi Saab, you mentioned that you would like to, this is an old theme of yours, you've written about it a lot. I've read you on this many times. Your claim is that Pakistan is a very resilient country. And I think there's no one better than you to talk about the economic history of Pakistan. You associated with most of the policymakers, you knew them well. You have written about it the most. So can you please tell us why you think Pakistan is resilient and what in its economic history were the mistakes that were made and what were the good things that were done?
Well, Nadeem, I have always been impressed by the fact as to how many crises we have faced throughout our life as a nation and how much we were able to do in order to deal with these crises. That's the positive aspect. Mm-hmm. The negative aspect is that we did not learn a great deal from the way we dealt with these crises. Let me start at the beginning. Mm-hmm. I have always been intrigued by the fact that how little our younger generation knows about the founding of the state of Pakistan. Mm-hmm. In 1947, when Pakistan was created, it had absolutely nothing. There was no government, there was no capital, there was very little banking going on, there was no central bank, there was nothing in the treasury that Pakistan could tap in order to deal with some of the major issues that came up when partition took place and Pakistan became independent. One of the most difficult situation that Pakistan faced was the arrival of 8 million refugees, Muslim refugees from India. At that time, Pakistan's population was 30 million. 6 million Hindus and Sikhs left in the opposite direction, leaving a population of 24 million. So we added 8 million people to a population of 24 million, which means that when the first census was taken, which was in 1951, one out of every four Pakistanis was a refugee. This is an incredible performance in the sense that these people were settled in about 3, 4, 5 years, and they became part of the Pakistani economy and part of the Pakistani society. I don't think there is any other parallel in human history of this kind of pressure of refugees on a population and in a country which was still struggling to stand on its feet.
But Barki Saab, isn't that in after many a revolution, let's say Vietnam or China or, you know, many a revolution, there's disruption of major kinds and countries do survive that and build, rebuild. For example, Vietnam has rebuilt back very quickly.
The fact that these countries had something to rely on in order to deal with the various dislocations that took place, but Pakistan had absolutely nothing. And on top of that, India had a very hostile attitude towards Pakistan. I have looked into some of the records that are available all over the place, particularly in London, as to what the Indians did in order to cripple Pakistan at the time of its birth. Just to give you a couple of examples, electricity was switched off. Lahore got a part of its electric supply from a power station on the other side of the border, and they switched it off. And so Lahore was left. I mean, today we talk about load shedding and so forth. That was a major, major event in the history of Lahore, which was then the largest Pakistani city. Then, I mean, you know this very well, what the Indians did in 1949, when Pakistan refused to devalue its currency with respect to the dollar. It was the only country which did not follow all members of the Sterling Area, as it was called then, now it's called the Commonwealth. And the Indians said that we don't accept this decision. And Sardar Vallabhbhai Patel, who was then the Interior Minister of India, famously said that India refuses to pay 144 Indian rupees for 100 Pakistani rupees. And in one day, India brought down the curtain and Pakistan was isolated. At that time, something like 65% of Pakistan's imports came from India and about 70% of Pakistani exports went to India. There was enormous dependence on India. Now, I remember I was very young, 10, 11 years old at that point, that my mother would put hot water on our toothpaste plus salt and add salt to it. That's the way we brushed our teeth because toothpaste were not available. Toothpaste came from India. So that was the kind of level of deprivation. So Nehru threatened that he will stop the flow of water into the Pakistani irrigation system. This was in 1950 or 49. And that brought Liaquat Ali Khan, famous appearance of Liaquat Ali Khan on the balcony of the Prime Minister's house. And he showed a mukha, a fist. And he said, we will go to war if India stops the flow of water. So that was another hit at Pakistan. So essentially the point I'm making is, and then of course, even before that, India refused to release sterling balances to Pakistan. Now, what are sterling balances? This is the amount of money that Britain gave to India and Pakistan in order to pay back these two countries for their war effort, the contribution they had made to Britain to deal with the Second World War. And it was negotiated, and I think Pakistan's share was 17% in the total, and it was negotiated by Liaquat Ali Khan, who was the finance minister in the interim cabinet. And Liaquat Ali Khan then asked Nehru to release that amount, and Nehru refused. Absolutely no grounds for refusing it. It was Pakistani money because Pakistan didn't have a treasury, didn't have a central bank. It was not lying in Pakistan. It was lying in India, waiting for Pakistan to gain independence and get the money. And Nehru refused, which took Nehru and Ghulam Mohammad, who was then the finance minister, to Delhi to plead with Nehru to release that money because Pakistan had absolutely nothing, no foreign exchange, zero. And Nehru refused. Then Mountbatten suggested to Liaquat Ali Khan that go and see Gandhi. Liaquat Ali Khan went and met Gandhi, and Gandhi said it is India's moral duty to give the money to Pakistan because it is Pakistan's money. And he called up Nehru and he said, please release the money. And Nehru said, if you interfere with my with the way I'm managing all this, I will resign. Now, people say that it is that particular episode which eventually led to the assassination of Gandhi, because the Hindu rightists very, very upset with that. So these are stories.
So, Malki Sahib, I accept your viewpoint that we were born in a hostile environment, but tell us, what was our policy response? Could we have done something or could we have not done something? Did we do the right things or did we not do the right things?
No, I think we did the right things. Okay. We created a government, we created institutions, State Bank of Pakistan was created. It was a well-managed crisis resolution that was undertaken. But then there was a problem. The problem was on the political side. Pakistanis were not able to create a political structure the way the Indians were. And the reason for that was that arrival of 8 million refugees, they had to be accommodated in the political system. The Punjabi establishment was not prepared to do that because a large, I think the ratio was about 20% of the total were from the minority provinces, UP, Bihar, Orissa, Bombay and so forth. And the Punjabi establishment was not prepared to accommodate in the political structure. Now, these people were much more educated than the Punjabi population, and therefore they were dominant in the bureaucratic system. Your father, for instance, was one of the 81 ICS officers who opted to serve in Pakistan. A very large number of these people were from areas that were not part of Pakistan when Pakistan was created. So there was a conflict between... In one of my books, I have said that there was a competition between the outsiders and insiders. And the insiders refused to accommodate outsiders, and that delayed Pakistan's political development, and Pakistan was not able to create a constitution. The Indians did it in a couple of years. Their constitution was drafted in 1950, and I think it was in 1951 that India became a republic. But... answer to your question is that given all the problems, Pakistan did well.
So that is the initial setup. Then we come forward. There was a huge promise of development. Let me put it this way. You were in fact there in the government then when there was a huge promise of development and people were looking to Pakistan to be the next Korea. So we took some right steps again. And what happened then?
I think... the Ayub era, and I started my service in Pakistan in 1960, and Ayub was then in charge of Pakistan for a couple of years. What happened was that Ayub, I think, was misled by Bhutto, and he was told that this is now the time to finally settle the Kashmir problem. And so very amateurish handling of that particular situation. Pakistan sent tens of thousands of people across the border into Kashmir in order to create some kind of revolution over there. That didn't happen. And you know the story. Indians attacked Lahore and there was a 17-day war. It was a brutal affair. A lot of people were killed. But that upset the momentum that Ayub had generated. My own view is that Bhutto did it deliberately. Bhutto wanted to humble the Pakistani army so that the military would not intervene again as it had done under Ayub Khan. So that was a major setback. Americans who were giving a lot of assistance to Pakistan because Pakistan was supporting the American effort to contain communism, stopped all aid. And I was then a part of the government. Our mutual friend Pervez Hassan was the chief economist of West Pakistan. In those days, there were two provinces, West Pakistan and East Pakistan. And to deal with that situation was very difficult. Pakistan didn't have all that many resources. It had embarked on a very ambitious program, and I think that's where the downturn started and persisted for a long time.
Okay.
So then
what happened
after that?
Well, what happened after that, I mean, you know this more than I do, Pakistan's inability to structure its economy in a way that it could pay a significant amount of resources it needed from its own resource generation. It was not able to do this. And the reason for that is that the political system, when it came about, some kind of institution structure was dominated by the landed community, by the landlords, and they were not prepared to pay taxes. So we then launched a kind of a cultural structure in which people were not prepared to participate by paying taxes and generating revenues for the government, and we've lived with that situation. Now, if you go forward, we have three periods of fairly significant growth. The U period, the Zia period, and the Musharraf period. And in all these periods, growth became possible because there was a large amount of money coming in from the United States. And the United States was following its own strategic interests, and it wanted Pakistan to help it in various ways, and Pakistan did and was paid off. So every time foreign savings are available, Pakistan does well. When foreign savings are not available, Pakistan does poorly. So savings, domestic savings, is a very low proportion of GDP. And that has meant that we are not able to raise resources in order to provide for even some of the basic functions that the people demand from the government and are convinced that it is the government's duty to provide them with this. Mm-hmm. And we continue to live with that situation to this day.
I think you've laid it out very nicely, that the as foreign savings come in, the country grows. But, you know, your prescription is that we need to increase domestic savings. But I really don't know how to increase domestic savings. I think we've seen a number of studies, and you were at the World Bank, there were a number of studies that people did. And there was used to be a time when savings studies were a fad in research. But we found out that there was nothing to be learned from those studies, and then people gave up. Now, the second thing is taxation. If we increase taxation, that doesn't increase savings. That just increases distribution from the private sector to the government. So it will not be the same impact as foreign savings coming in. When foreign savings comes in, it's like a sugar daddy infusing resources into the economy. So I don't think taxation will do it. So what's your prescription? Is there another alternative, or is it just that we should collect taxes first before we can grow?
You know, when I talk about savings, I don't really mean taxes. Mm-hmm. I mean domestic savings. Mm-hmm. People putting money into...
But that's what I'm saying. We don't know how to increase savings. The whole economics profession has kind of done a number of studies and come up with nothing.
No. And Nadeem, you know this, mm-hmm. that confidence is an extremely important variable.
Okay.
And people have lost confidence in the country's future.
Okay.
And therefore, you know, I spend a fair amount of time every year in Singapore, and I've come to know some senior bankers over there. And they tell me that Pakistan is either the third or the fourth largest source of capital flowing into Singapore. This is private money coming in. People are taking money out of Pakistan and putting it in savings accounts in the Singapore banking system. I get the same thing is being done in Malaysia. Now, people are afraid that Pakistan has no future, and therefore they are prepared to settle for very low rates of return in order to save whatever they have accumulated. And so, I mean, in economics, you know this.
That so where did we lose confidence in ourselves? What happened?
I think a series of crises, mm-hmm. Which we have not been able to handle. Mm-hmm. You know, I have been persuaded now. I didn't used to think that way, but now I've been persuaded that there is a very close relationship between politics and economics. If one of these things go wrong, it impacts on the other. The political system in Pakistan has done very poorly, and that has created an impact on the economic side. And people are therefore not very comfortable that the country will be able to, you know, work its way through many, many crises that we face at this point, security issue, terrorism, and so on being important ones. So there is a sizable capital flight. And if capital continues to flow, then obviously investments are not being made. I'm not talking about debt to GDP ratio. I'm talking about savings to GDP.
No, fair enough. I appreciate that. But Kisa, my problem is that, my question is really that where and when, I mean, you began off by, and I agree with you entirely, that we handled the initial formation of Pakistan reasonably well. During the Ayub period, we began a growth or some kind of a policy for generating growth and developing our country, which was fairly well appreciated around the world. Then came the 65 war. And after that, we kind of, somewhere along the line, we lost our path. And we've been struggling since then. If you think about it, okay, after the 65 war, we went into the Bhutto nationalization period, first the Bangladesh, then we got into the nationalization. After the nationalization, the Aulak came along, and we developed a kind of a muddle-through approach. And then we hit the IMF program around about 1980, and since then we've been in and out of IMF programs and kind of had no real handle on our domestic policy. Would you agree with that kind of summing up? Would you add something to it?
No, I basically agree with it. Mm-hmm. But you left out one of the major shocks that was delivered to the Pakistani economy, mm-hmm. by Bhutto's nationalization. Mm-hmm. When Bhutto went for expropriation of private assets, mm-hmm. The private sector was doing reasonably well in Pakistan. You mentioned that Pakistan could have been Korea, and one reason is that the private sector, because of Ayub Khan's promotion of private investment and giving a lot of space to private enterprise, there were a lot of companies that had begun to do very well in the banking sector, in commercial sector, in industry, and so on. Now, Bhutto knew... I knew Bhutto a little bit, not all that much. I knew Ayub much better than I knew Bhutto. Bhutto had very little knowledge of economics. Mm-hmm. And this roti kapra makan business, Bhutto had persuaded himself that he had to follow Nehru's approach, put the state on the commanding heights of the economy. Mm-hmm. You remember that Lenin phrase,
sure.
Which Nehru had adopted for his own use. Now, whereas the Indians, and Nehru's approach was to let the government invest in creating public assets, Bhutto, instead of that, Bhutto just expropriated very well-functioning entities, enterprises, and so on. And that was a real setback, and we have not really recovered from that. And then, the way he managed the economy, letting people be employed by PIA, the railways, and so on, the few assets that Pakistan had were doing reasonably well, were just, horribly treated and created enormous amount of problems that we are still dealing with. In my book, Nadeem, there are two villains in Pakistan's history. One is Bhutto, and the other is Ziaul-Haq. And both did an enormous amount of damage. Initially, I was positive about Zia. I wrote a book which came out.
I remember that.
As Pakistan under the military. And I was positive because I knew Ghulam Issa Khan very well, extremely well. And I thought he was managing the economy reasonably well and that he was working very hard to have the economy recover from the shocks that Bhutto had given. But then Zia came along and introduced Islamization and all that stuff, and we haven't recovered from that particular shock.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But would you not say that that Bhutto happened more than 40 years ago, and Ziaul-Haq also happened more than 30 years ago, and as I alluded before to Korea, to Vietnam, for example, which recovered after devastating war, carpet bombing and everything, in a very short period of time. Should Pakistan not have got over those events? And, you know, our industrialists, for example, should they not have gotten over those events? Look at Korea. Korea, for example, came out of the Korean War and came roaring out, and, you know, did very well. I mean, these examples you know better than I do. You worked in these countries. The issue that I would like to raise is that there is something else in our policy that, yes, of course, I agree with you on all that, but there's something else in our policies that I'd like to identify the economic policies that went wrong.
I think there are a number of things that are problematic on the policy front and also on the institutional front. I once wrote an article, which people remember. I called Pakistan a graveyard of institutions. We have systematically destroyed, either through neglect or through overt policies, many, many functioning institutions. The service which I joined as a young man, Civil Service of Pakistan, was doing good work for Pakistan. It was a very clean service.
It was a good service, yeah.
It was providing, you know, I could have gone into the private sector and made 5-6 times more money than I got as a member of the civil service. At that time, you know, your father and his colleagues were looked upon by people like myself, younger people, as the role models that we could follow. They were hardworking, they were committed, they were very clean. And that has gone. Today, we really don't have a civil service that we can rely upon in order to do the things that need to be done. I don't know if you've seen the latest Economist. It is a very interesting article on Vietnam. And it makes the point that you are making, that Vietnam has now become the new East Asian tiger. Yep. And it has done that by allowing the private sector enormous amount of role in the economy by taking care of what the government needs to take care of. You mentioned two things that the government has done very well. One is education. They have not just primary and secondary education, but technical education. So they have now a very large number of people. Vietnam is a country of 90 million people, fairly young population, and they have created skills which they are putting to use as China opts out of some of these areas. Vietnam has become a very attractive source of these kinds of enterprises, and there's a lot of investment going into Vietnam from the United States and Europe and so forth. China, for instance, as you know, I worked in China for 7 years, and I used to say that China is where it is today because of Mao Zedong, which was not a popular thing to say in China in those days, because Mao was treated as more of a monster than a creator of modern China. But what did Mao do, which has benefited China enormously? He did three things: universal education, universal health care, and emancipation of women. The first time I went to China was in 1965. I was sent there by the Yu government. I led a three-member delegation to China in order to study the system of communes. And when we arrived over there, I was horrified to see big women walking on feet that were about 3-4 inches long. And, I mean, these were people who had gone through this foot binding fetish of the Chinese. Now, from that, we have come to the point where, you know, women occupy very senior places and so on. So these were the things that China did at a tremendous loss, human loss. Millions of people were killed as a result of what Mao was doing. But nevertheless, I would say that when the bottom line is arrived at, his role was very positive. And then China was very lucky in having Deng Xiaoping succeed Mao and open the economy, bringing the private sector and so on and so forth.
But then, Barki Sahib, you point out that institutionally, we failed. And the key objectives that the world has learned, that Mao somehow figured out in 1949, that we need to get education going, we need to get women emancipated, we need to get an egalitarian culture going. All those things we failed on. Now, at the same time, you turn around and you said, you know, that Pakistan was doing all right and we are resilient and we weathered crises. Yes, of course, we weathered crises. But maybe some of these crises are of our own making. Take, for example, the macroeconomic crisis that we've lived with for the last 35, 40 years. Is that not of our own making? Can't we address our fiscal situation on our own?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I'm not saying that the crises were created all the time by India or United States pulling out and so on. Mm-hmm. We have contributed a lot to our critical situation. Mm-hmm. But so has the world. I mean, the world has pushed us in the direction in which we should not have gone. Mm-hmm. When you read Zia's book, In the Line of Fire, it's amazing.
Musharraf's book.
Musharraf's book. Yeah. Musharraf's book, In the Line of Fire. And I'm amazed that the guy took a few seconds to decide that he's going to side with the Americans. And then, you know, creation of Mujahideen and Taliban and so on and so forth. In siding with the Americans, we paid very little attention to our long-term strategic interests. We thought that this is an easy source of money. All this, you know, then ties up, you know, very low domestic savings rate, very low investment to GDP ratios, dependence on foreign aid, and therefore, whenever some opportunity arises which would result in flow of money into the country, we'll take it without thinking the long-term implications of those kinds of moves. So, yes, it is policy-oriented.
But Barghi Sahib, let me also ask you, you mentioned aid dependence, and this is a subject that touches to the core. Pakistan started off being a darling of the aid community in their Ubira. As you rightly pointed out, we did very well, but we were aid dependent then. And we followed, let's bring some economics in, we followed the two-gap model, we followed the Harrod-Domar model, and we were beginning to grow through mainly aid dependence and accumulation of capital through licenses, etc. Fair enough. But has the model changed much? I see that our Prime Minister even today is running after aid, looking to China, looking to UK or US or whatever. Same thing for Musharraf, same thing for Zardari, same thing for even Ziaul Haq. We have a perennial hunt for aid. And I've been in government, you've been in government. The pressure from the bureaucrats always is to look for aid. Is that a good model, or is it like Keynes said, that we are marching to the tune of a defunct economist?
No, I think it's an awful model. And that's what I've been saying all along, that we have to bring about serious structural changes, political, cultural, economic, in order to increase our ability to depend on our own resources, rather than go around with a begging bowl all the time. I think I've written about this, but let me talk about
it. Elaborate. What are the structural changes that you'd like to see?
No, but before I go to that, when Zardari became president, I got desperate calls from Islamabad via Hussain Haqqani, who was then the ambassador over here, saying that Zardari wanted to see you. Mm-hmm. And I was rather puzzled. Why this kind of hysterical stuff? So I, after resisting it, I arrived in Islamabad and I went to see him. And he said to me, Mr. Barghi, I want your help. I want to get resources from China. And I said, what kind of resources? He said, unattached resources. In other words, free flow of money into our budget. And he said, I went to China and I said to them that, you know, give me $1 billion. And the Chinese said, no, we don't give that kind of money. And he said, I had been briefed that some government got $500 million from the Chinese. So I said to them, no, you've given $500 million. And they said, yes, we have, but that was to Mr. Barghi, not to Pakistan, because he did so much for us. And when he was finance minister, his country was close to bankruptcy. He came over here and we gave him $500 million. That was an exception. And we are not prepared to do that again. So then Zardari said to me, he said, I was surprised that you are held in high esteem even now in Beijing. And so can you please work with me and get the Chinese to agree to give us that kind of resource? And I said, no, I will not do that. I said, that was a desperate move by me, because Pakistan owed, I forget now how much it was, $115 million to IMF, and there was a payment due to the bank. And if we had not gotten that, we would have defaulted. And as you know, default is a horrible thing, particularly when it is when it concerns preferred creditors. So, you know, without thinking this thing through, he was desperate to get free money from China, and he was prepared to do anything that could be done. Have you seen this book by Andrew Small called, it's about China-Pakistan relationship?
No, I haven't. Go ahead.
It's a very depressing book, and it talks about all these things that mm-hmm. we have gotten the Chinese to do for us, and how even when the Chinese were willing, we continue to bungle. I mean, he has a bias. He has a very strong mm-hmm. anti-Pakistan bias. Mm-hmm. But it's a depressing story mm-hmm. that even when all this begging does produce money, mm-hmm. we don't use it very well.
But Barki Sahab, we like to get the money, but the IMF, for example, would say, and I'm sure you've heard it said, that we take the money, but we are not willing to follow the policy.
Yes.
Would you agree with that?
Absolutely.
Okay. Then please tell me, how you've been in government, you've followed governments, you know this far better than I do, although I've seen it from inside too. How is policy made in Pakistan? And would you think it's a good way to make policy?
No. I mean, you know, Nadeem, you know this more than I do. You were three years
in the as a deputy chairman. Yeah,
3 years. Mm-hmm. Okay, you were in charge of the planning commission. In my days, mm-hmm. planning commission made policies, mm-hmm. and everybody followed those policies. Mm-hmm. In your time, I don't think you were allowed.
Absolutely not. I've said this many times. Yeah,
that kind of space. Mm-hmm. The current government wrote this 2025 or 2030?
Vision 2025.
2025. Mm-hmm. And the current chairman of the Planning Commission sent it to me mm-hmm. and said, love to have your comments. So I read it. Mm-hmm. It's written by a mutual friend of ours. Mm-hmm. And very well written, good diagnosis, but absolutely zero in terms of what kind of policies are needed. Mm-hmm. To care of the problems that were well investigated in this particular document. So nobody is prepared to put on the thinking hat and say, given all these problems, what is it that we should be doing? Mm-hmm. We don't have a policy-making apparatus in place. It is knee-jerk reaction to whatever is happening to us so that we can get over that particular incident in order to get to the following day. There is very, very little. Tell me if I'm right. No,
I fully agree with you. But tell me, what would you do to set up such a system?
Well, that's a very difficult question to answer. I would straighten politics mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. and make politicians accountable to somebody. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I don't know how they become. I mean, I'm sure you've read this book, Why Nations Fail. And these two guys, one economist, other political scientist, point out that unless you have both inclusive economic and political systems, you cannot have stability in the country. And we have neither an inclusive political system nor an inclusive economic system. How can this be created? I really don't know. And even Acemoglu and Robinson don't tell us. Or do you move from exclusive to inclusive systems? But I think we need to recognize that that's needed.
I think that's a very important point, and you're absolutely right, that's needed. But tell me, in terms of our aid dependence, I think, would you agree with me? I think our policies are normally made by donors. I found that ministers are very willing to sign a donor document and call it a policy and take it to the cabinet, right? And the cabinet, I find, has no time or inclination or capacity to study any document. I mean, you were in the World Bank, for example. You know how the, you remember, you've obviously dealt with it many times, how the board worked and how the staff presented proposals to the board. Can you tell us if we have something like that in Pakistan? And do you think that the donors actually make the policies for us or not?
I think donors make the policies for us. Now, you've been on the donor side of the equation also. Yeah. I have been more so than on the recipient side. Donors really don't know all that much about the countries that they're dealing with. I'll give you an example. I don't even remember a guy called Bevan Wade. He was chief economist of South Asia. And he once invited me to speak at a retreat that he had organized for his economists working in South Asia. And the subject was policy advice to Pakistan. So I picked up four or five annual reports that the bank had done. And I read through those. And then I developed a simple matrix on what the bank was advising to whether it was feasible politically to follow that advice. If it was not, what needed to be done on both the recipient side and the donor side. So I made that presentation. And the economists were very intrigued by that. And my conclusion was that most of the time, the bank was asking Pakistan to do, which Pakistan was institutionally too weak to carry out or too entrenched in terms of interests to accept they did, but to implement that advice. So Bevan Wade's conclusion after I had finished was very interesting. He said, you know, this was a fascinating presentation. But Javed, let me say the following to you, that nobody in Pakistan, amongst the people dealing with Pakistan at the bank, know Pakistan as well as you do. And therefore, we can't do the kind of analysis that you have done. And I said, I'm very disappointed. I said, I'm working, in those days, I was director of China. And I said, I know China as well as the Chinese know China. So this is not an excuse that because we are not Pakistanis, we don't know Pakistan. So a lot of the donors are relying on people who have just very, very small, not terribly intense knowledge of the country that they're dealing with.
Right? This is probably about 20 or 30 years ago?
This is 1993, I think.
So about 20 plus 20. Years ago, right? And yeah. Things have changed since then, or you think they've gone worse?
Well, I'm not in touch with the bank now.
I'm not talking about the bank, in general.
You mean for the donors?
Donors in general.
Oh, yeah. I mean, things are pretty bad. The donor community knows very little about the countries, not as well as they should. That's the point I'm making.
Now, let me ask you, I think what I read from what you're saying, a very important message that comes through to me, would you agree with that? That it seems that Pakistan has lost the capacity to make policy that it had. And by capacity, I mean both the skills as well as the processes for adopting good policy. The research capacity, for example, bureaucracy used to do research in the old days, as we see in the India Office Library. Now it doesn't happen. So I think part of the prescription might be to create that capacity. And while we talk about capacity building, nobody really makes that capacity. Why is that? And what can we do about that?
We have, temperamentally, I guess, we are short-termers. We don't think long. We think short. Second, I think loss of confidence in the country's future means that we have now settled into a kind of situation where personal gain is much more important than national gain. And we follow what's good for me, what's good for my friends, what's good for my family, rather than what's good for the country and for the nation. So with that kind of attitude, it's a cavalier attitude. I don't think we can do much unless we change that. How we can change it, I really don't know.
Like you said, you might, you've obviously seen this and probably read this book, Fukuyama's book on this political order that two-volume set. The point that he makes is that in when it comes to weak state or state in disorder, people obviously become very individualistic and start looking about personal safety and start the kind of behavior that you've talked about in Pakistan, which is happening right now. Me first, and I want to take my money out of the country. So it's probably, I mean, I'm hypothesizing, it could probably be due to the fact that the governance structure is weak. And as you say, it's a graveyard of institutions. So perhaps the key reform that needs to be made is to start gradually building up the institutions. And that's a reform that nobody seems to be willing to take, especially the donors, because they are also short-term in thinking. So in terms of ourselves, if I think about it, the one proposal that I came up with the Planning Commission is that perhaps we should start setting up a large research agenda and start thinking about things and start a debate domestically. But for that, the government has no money. And the donors also don't want to give money. Would you agree with such a suggestion, and would you agree that this such a thing should be developed or not? I know, and I should put that up too, which I didn't in your introduction, but it's worth making the point now. You have established a think tank in Pakistan called the Shahid Javed Barkhi Institute. So you are heading in that direction by your actions. But I'm saying, should this be a part of the policy setup or not?
Absolutely. I mean, I couldn't agree more with you. And the government doesn't have the resources, the government doesn't have the inclination. There is a lot of money in the private sector. We can possibly create some enthusiasm amongst people who are prepared to think about Pakistan and do something positive about Pakistan. I mean, the guy who's really done this and done this very well is Babar Ali. I mean, he's committed his time, his money, and he's created a wonderful institution. I obviously cannot match his resources, but I'm putting a lot of my personal money into this. My hope is that other people will do this. Ishrat Hussain tells me that there are people in Karachi who are now coming out, and I think the Habib family has done something, and one of the Daud fellows have set up.
What they want to do is set up colleges. They are not thinking in terms of setting up thinking institutions for developing a thinking culture. One thing I don't agree with you, Barkhi Sahib, I think the government has the money. I mean, for example, I tried very hard to just allow 1 billion rupees out of the PSTP to be put up for research. And the finance ministry shot it down. Now, 1 billion is not a lot of money. These days, it'll be like 1% of the PSTP. So 1% of the PSTP putting up for research, and that, I think, would really do a lot, because right now we don't need a lot of money to galvanize the first steps, the initial step. We need a small amount of money. But the even bigger issue is donors are not willing to put up any money into such an enterprise. Donors give $100 million, $200 million to their own companies sitting here on the Beltway. As you know, the famous Beltway bandits. They get $100 million, $200 million, but when I ask the donors to put in $100 million or even $10 million for research in Pakistan and give it, let's say, to LUMS or Qaeda University or something, they said, no, we can't do that. Now, how would you see that?
Yeah, I mean, we should not accept this kind of relationship with the donors. We should be firm. And we should say that exactly what you're saying, that we need to build institutions, we need to have people who can think things through, we need to have a debate, a conversation, books written, articles written, and so on and so forth. You mentioned Francis Fukuyama's book, right?
Yeah.
Now, I know Francis reasonably well. He and I work for the same guy. But at different times, Samuel Huntington. I introduced Samuel Huntington to Pakistan, and I told him how Ayub had collapsed. He was a great admirer of Ayub Khan, and he began to understand what then became political order in changing societies. Pakistan was, I wrote about it and I gave it to him and so on. But about that time that his book came out, another very good book came out. And for me, that's a classic statement of where we are today. And that's Exit, Voice, and Loyalty. Now, we are now at the exit stage. Again, if you look at the Economist, the latest Economist, they have a very nice, well-researched article on the youth bulge in the Arab societies. And they don't use Hirschman's kind of argument. But I think we've come to a point where there are a lot of very unhappy people, particularly the youth. I did some very back-of-the-envelope type of analysis, and I concluded that Pakistan's median age is about 24 years. However, which means 50% of the population is below that age. But I concluded that 75% of the population of Pakistan's two largest cities, Karachi and Lahore, is below the age of 24. And this is a very restless group of people. And unless their aspirations are fulfilled somehow, they may exit into extremism, and then all hell is going to break loose.
Fair enough. The imperative of getting growth going is important. So, Barki Saab, my final question. I think this conversation can go on for hours, and we must extend it. We must do more. It is extremely important for Pakistani thinkers, especially the youth who are studying, to which this podcast is directed, to hear what you're saying. My final question is, how do we get growth going in Pakistan? I keep hearing this issue about lack of resources, and I keep saying resources is not an issue, because I can think up a number of ways where economic reform will generate resources. I can think up a number of ways where economic reform will generate so much resources that we can even retire our debt. But yet, I think there is a lack of comprehension amongst our community, the thinkers, the economic professionals, to think of these reforms to move forward. Instead, they are stuck with the old adage that we have no resources.
I'll give you three ideas mm-hmm. that we should play with. Mm-hmm. One of them is short term, and the other two are sort of medium term. The short term is that we should have leadership that can create certain amount of excitement in the country. These people should be keen, they should be motivated, they should be interested in Pakistan's future. And the message they should communicate is all these three. We are committed, we are clean, and we are interested in the future. And I would be not surprised at all if enormous amount of money becomes available, people will gain confidence and begin to invest in the country again. The second thing is investment. We need to invest in developing our human resource. We need to give the right kind of education to our young people so that they are available to the economy to do the kinds of things that other people have done in other places. And my third thing is just look at the map of Pakistan. It is sitting on top of India. It is right next to China. It is south of Central Asia, which is very resource rich. I think we need to, settle with India. And that is absolutely of primary importance in a way that we can make use of our location in order to benefit ourselves. Mm-hmm. It won't be easy because Indians are not easy people to deal with. I deal with them all the time. In Singapore, all kind of people pass through Singapore, and they don't like Pakistan, and many of them are prepared to do damage to the country. But that notwithstanding, I think it is our interest to work with India in a way that benefit accrues to us.
I take your point, Barki Saab, and I think quite frankly these things can be should be examined much more, and we should. That's why we need the thinking in Pakistan and the debate in Pakistan to happen so that we can pick up on these ideas and develop them further. And I hope that our students and our thinkers will learn from your conversation and pick up some hypotheses and ideas to research. There's a lot of things to research here, the graveyard of institutions, the strategy going forward, how do we reorganize our policy, what questions do we ask, how do we research these questions. Lastly, I would ask you to give us a book recommendation. What would you recommend What's on the top of your mind right now? I know you read a lot. So what's on top of your mind right now? And what do you think that every Pakistani student of economics, every Pakistani thinker must read? And your reasons as to why you recommend that book. I would also add, you can also add a movie if you like.
Sorry?
You can also add a movie if you like.
A movie. I don't watch movies, unfortunately. Okay. Books, I think there are two or three books that I have read, and I've enjoyed them, and I've benefited a lot of them. And I'm sure you have read all three. Mm-hmm. One is Thomas Piketty's book, Capitalism in the 21st Century. Mm-hmm. What did it do for me? It showed me how important it is to have the right kind of state in order to make sure that the capital that gets accumulated, invested, and the returns that it produces is distributed reasonably equitably and not the way it's happening in the West. So it's a very powerful book, and I would recommend that. It's a big book. It takes time to read it. The second book I mentioned that in our conversation is Why Nations Fail. This is by Darren Acemoglu and James Robinson, one of MIT, the other at Harvard. And they point out how important it is to think in terms of both politics and economics in order to fashion what needs to be done with the countries that we are dealing with. And the third book we've also talked about, it's a big book, it's in two volumes. I forget the title of the book, it's by Francis Fukuyama. Yeah. Now, Francis has come a long way. Remember, he wrote a book called, The Last Man.
The End of History.
The End of History and The Last Man and so on. Now, he's left that confidence which he had because of the fall of the Soviet Empire and so on. And he's now very, he is skeptical that liberal democracy will work unless it is not taken care of. And he takes the example of what's happening in the United States. Now, that was written before Mr. Trump came along. So,
he needs to write an epilogue, huh?
Has he written an epilogue?
No, I'm saying he needs to write one.
He needs to write an epilogue, yes. But he's a much wiser man after his earlier book, The End of History. But I am extremely concerned, Nadeem, about what's happening in the United States and also what's happening in Britain. This is the rise of angry people who have very little knowledge of what is happening to them, but they're just full of anger. And that's going to create systems in both Europe and the United States, which will play havoc with the global economy.
Markisab, we will do another episode, in fact, another two or three episodes. One I'd like to do on China with you, because I think we need to really, really unpack China for Pakistanis, because Pakistanis have a very romantic notion of China. There's a lot of romance with China, but there's other things too, and we must have a hardcore, realistic discussion with you. The other one I also want to discuss global developments with you, because I know you've done some work there too. You're writing a book on that. So mm-hmm. We'll leave that for later. On the last word that I'll say on Fukuyama, Fukuyama has attacked a number of subjects, Barkisab. He's a favorite of mine. He's the grand intellectual thinker that I would strive to be, but cannot be. He has not just The End of History, for example, is a very important thing because it created a huge debate in this country. And I think it's a very, very important piece. And I wish we could have something like that happen in Pakistan. Mm-hmm. Similarly, his book, The Trust, was a beautiful book. Well done. Then his book, Post a Human Future, was beautiful. And then, the only reason I'm mentioning all this is because there are leading public intellectuals here that do lead a debate. One of them is, for example, not just Fukuyama, there are others too. I won't name them, but in any case, this debate has helped this country a lot. But you're right. With Trump arriving, we are at a very interesting pass, and we will both see whether the U.S. is crossing this path and how it's crossing it and how well it's crossing it. But it's more than Trump. As you mentioned, Piketty, it's also Piketty's work that needs to be addressed. So there's a lot of stuff to be addressed, but we will talk about that later, Barkisab. Thank you very much. It's wonderful talking to you, and we will, inshallah, do this again.
Pleasure. Thanks, Nadeem.
Soch Bachar ke saath, mera naam Nadeem Ul Haq hai.
Aur mera naam Anjum Altaf hai.